beans, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Scream 6, Champions, The Magic Flute, History of the World Part 2, and a look back at Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. I'm also going to be talking about some news and the trailer park and the home cinema roundup featuring Christmas, Bloody Christmas. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's first take a look at the box office really quickly. Creed 3 did extremely well, as I predicted, even though I didn't like the movie. But I predicted it would be a big hit. I knew it was a crowd pleaser, and it made $58 million over the weekend, which is phenomenal, actually. Not only is that the highest grossing opening weekend of a Rocky or a movie in the Rocky series, which really, let's face it, you can really only compare this to the first two Creed movies, even Rocky Balboa, maybe. But I mean, to sit there and compare this to like Rocky 3 or Rocky 4 in the 80s is a little disingenuous. Those movies were massive hits when they came out. So anyways, and apparently this is at least what the studio is saying. It's the highest opening weekend gross for a sports movie ever. Kudos to Creed. Kudos to Michael B. Jordan. Kudos to the producers. They did a great job making a movie that people liked, even if it wasn't catered to me. But that's okay. Not everything has to be catered to me. Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania went to second place in a distant second with just under $13 million, which brings its domestic total to $187 million, which is low for a Marvel movie. And everyone's like, oh, it's leading into phase 5 and everyone's going to be disappointed. And oh, it's just the Marvel movies are ending. This is actually 100% on par with the other Ant-Man movies. They all make somewhere between $150 and $200 million domestically, and then they end up topping out, I don't know, it was, I think the first one was about $500 million, and the second one was like $600 and some million dollars worldwide. So it's completely on track to do exactly that. So I wouldn't exactly start having a bake sale for Marvel for this. Cocaine Bear came in slightly less at $11 million for number 3, which is a pretty good hold for that movie. There's another Demon Slayer movie that came out, and that hit number 4 from Crunchyroll at $10 million. Then he had like Jesus Revolution and Avatar still out there kicking around. I don't know if it's going to break $700 million, but it might. Then that Operation Fortune Ruse de Guerre that Guy Ritchie did and Jason Statham started flopped into, seventh place. It ended up making $3.1 million, which not good for a Guy Ritchie movie. The next piece of news I want to hit is I want to give my Oscar predictions. Maybe you forgot, but the Oscars are this Sunday, and fans are going to be watching him and looking at him and saying what's going to happen. Now, I usually just do the big six, being the best picture, best director, and the actor and actress roles, and then the supporting roles. So let's start off with the best supporting actor role. I really think it's going to be Ki-Hoo Kwan for Everything Everywhere All at Once. Certainly the momentum is there for him. He's been picking up that award like pretty much everywhere. So I think that's one of the safest bets you're going to have. Now, best supporting actress, it's not going to be anybody from Everywhere All at Once, because I think, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis and Stephanie Soo have sort of canceled each other out. And like Hong Chow for The Whale and Kerry Condon, they're just not getting the traction. Angela Bassett for Black Panther Wakanda Forever, that's who I think is going to win. Now, when it comes to the lead actor and actress, let's talk about the lead actor. I think that one's the other one that's, I think, kind of a shoo-in is Brendan Fraser for The Whale. Now, anything can happen. You know, Paul Mescal could win for Aftersun, but I really think it's going to be Brendan Fraser. I mean, I guess his biggest competition is really Austin Butler for Elvis, and he's won a couple of these, but I don't expect to see that happening at the Oscars. I think Brendan Fraser is definitely going to win. Now, actress in a leading role, I think, is very interesting because the odds-on favorite is Cate Blanchett for Tar, but her momentum has slowed down quite a bit. And Michelle Yeoh for Everything Everywhere All at Once is definitely a contender. I mean, that's your underdog there. I think it's going to go to Cate, but I would not be surprised if it went to Michelle Yeoh. And you know, God bless you, Andrea Riseborough, for getting some traction for Ford Leslie, but that ain't going to win. Now, when it comes to directing and best picture, this is interesting because you always have more best picture nominees. There's like 10 of them versus the 5 for directing. And usually there's crossover, and there's all the directing Oscars for Banshees of Inisherin, Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Fabelmans, Tar, and Triangle of Sadness. All those are nominated for Best Picture, but you also have stuff that's not nominated for Best Director. And, you know, again, the prevailing wisdom would say Everything Everywhere All at Once is going to win Best Picture. And I think that's got a good shot. But I do not think the Daniels are going to win for directing that. I really think the Academy wants to give it to Steven Spielberg. And that's fair. I mean, it's Steven Spielberg, for crying out loud. And sure, his Fablemans might win Best Picture. I think that's sort of like the second choice behind Everything Everywhere All at Once. But here's the one. I'm going to just go out on a limb and say, do not discount All Quiet on the Western Front. That has made some major wins over award season, and that has, I don't know if I'd call it momentum, but it has this stability behind it. It's a remake of a classic film. It's anti-war. And wouldn't it be hilarious if All Quiet on the Western Front won as a Netflix film that they really didn't push the way they pushed stuff like The Glass Onion or White Noise or even Pinocchio? I mean, it wouldn't be bizarre if that's the one that wins that they didn't really put a huge push behind. And so that's the one in the last several years, in the last 10 years, there've been a lot of dark horses that have come up out of nowhere. Stuff like Coda, although that was a little bit predicted, but stuff like Green Book winning these major awards that nobody expected to win. So All Quiet on the Western Front, that's the one that I would almost go as far to say I want to predict that. So I have it on record as predicting that to win Best Picture. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Ghosted, which comes on Apple TV Plus on April 21st.
Any word?
She ghosted him.
I bet she isn't even seeing your text.
She does travel a lot for work.
Go to her.
I'm going to London.
Oh, God. You have the wrong guy?
I'm a former.
Wait.
Oh, whoa.
Who are you?
CIA.
So confused. They kept asking me about the taxman.
They asked you about the taxman?
They think I am a taxman. You're the taxman.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Ghosted is kind of a lark, and it falls into that very popular category of action rom-com, where you've got some very popular actors. You've got Ana de Maris and you've got Chris Evans, basically taking a romantic comedy and turning it into a spy movie. And that served very well for stuff like The Lost City or like that movie Shotgun Wedding. That one is the rom-com action movie. And those are really kind of a clicking thing now. And you've got somewhat of a light action movie that tends to get the attention of women and the attention of men. So this might be fun. I mean, it's going to be a throwaway movie. It's not going to be anything award-worthy, but it might be entertaining. I like both of them, and I have a real thing for Ana de Maris. She's adorable. The next one I want to talk about is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which comes to theaters on August 4th.
Wait, did you hear that? What was that?
Well, nothing we can do. You guys want to grab pizza?
Can I kick it? What the heck are those things?
They look like little Shreks to me.
So, you were baby turtles who made contact with mystery goo.
Well, we prefer the term ooze, but yeah.
It's like more like, it's just nicer.
It rolls off the tongue better, yeah.
Ooze. It's nice, right? It's ooze.
This is yet again another reboot of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They're ditching the live action CGI where you have a CGI version of the turtles, but it's in a live action movie, which is what they had a couple years ago. And those were okay. They just, the turtle designs were terrible. And it's not like the Jim Henson puppet type turtles that they had back in the 90s. This is done in sort of the style of animation as Into the Spider-Verse. And that's very popular right now. They also got actual honest to God teenagers to voice the turtles. Now they got big names. They got like Seth Rogen and John Cena as Rocksteady, and what's the other guy, the bad guys, and they got Jackie Chan as Splinter. So they've got stars, but I like the fact they actually went and got teenagers and they get like the Wayans brothers to do the turtles. So yeah, that one looks kind of fun. I tend to like animation. And with that, we're going to take a pause, and later we're going to be talking about History of the World Part 2 and the Magic Flute. This is a public service announcement. Manscaped now has beard products, and it's going even further with their brand new Weed Whacker 2.0. Go ahead and tell the world the leaders in below-the-line waist grooming are traveling north of your South Pole with their revolutionary grooming products. The new Weed Whacker 2.0 and their new beard line confirms that they have the best tools for your hygiene toolbox. Time for you to upgrade your game by going to manscaped.com and using our code FATGUYS for 20% off and free shipping. There's a lot of good stuff in here. You've got a beard trimmer with 20 different hair cutting lengths. You've got beard shampoo and conditioner and beard oil and beard balm all in this Beard Hedger Pro Kit. It gives you everything you need to trim everything nice. And then on top of it, you get all the little small parts, the nose hairs and the ears hair. Let's face it, hair is a great thing to have, but hair in some places is not. So check out the brand new Weed Whacker 2.0 with improved blades and skin-safe technology. Get 20% off and free shipping with our code FATGUYS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And use our code FATGUYS. Always use the right tool for the right job with Manscaped.
The Inquisition,
what a show.
The Inquisition,
here we go.
We know you're wishing that we'd go away, but the Inquisition's here and it's here to stay.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews and talk about History of the World Part 2. Nick Kroll, Ike Barinholtz, and Wanda Sykes present new sketches about the history of the world with the blessings of Mel Brooks.
I'm Kublai Khan.
Amelia Earhart.
The Romanovs.
I am Sigmund Freud. Join me for my masterclass.
Who are you?
Some call me Jesus Christ, Son of God.
Some call him Broken Corny.
We are about to embark on the biggest campaign in the history of the world, part two.
Noah, you were supposed to get two of every animal.
I got two chihuahuas, two Pekingeses, two pugs. Actually, I got three pugs. Don't tell God.
I remember when History of the World Part 1 came out in the 80s. I was actually too young. My parents would not allow me to see it because there were so many blue jokes in the movie. I mean, there's no nudity in it. There's really, in terms of offensive material, it's pretty low-key. But I didn't get to see it until sometime in the mid-80s on VHS. It's a funny movie. I'm a big Mel Brooks fan. I go back to loving stuff like High Anxiety and Young Frankenstein. But History of the World Part 1 was that old-school Mel Brooks. And the part of the joke was he was never going to make Part 2. In fact, I remember reading an interview with him once, and they asked him, are you going to make Part 2? And he goes, nah, I might make Part 5 at some point. Which, that's sort of the joke, is he never was going to continue it. And actually, at the end of History of the World Part 1, they have a silly promo for what would be in Part 2. Well, now here we are, 40-odd years later, and they're doing a Part 2. But as Mel Brooks jokes, they gave him enough money, and he kind of gives his blessing to it. Now, the reaction I've seen is so polarized. I mean, I don't see any middle ground. I see people either going, oh, it's the greatest, hilarious, most funny thing I've seen in forever, or people going, how dare you? This is terrible, and I hate everything because of this show. So, I mean, I don't see a middle ground. The reality is, there was no sacred cow involved in History of the World Part 1, unless there was one on screen somewhere that we didn't know about. And I'm talking about a literal cow. So don't have a cow about this. There's nothing untouchable about History of the World Part 1. And enough time has passed that why not do it? You know, why not have a little bit of fun with it? You're not remaking the movie. You're not just redoing the sketches. And the people who are out there talking about like the sketches in History of the World Part 2 as not being as good as the History of the World Part 1 sketches, you got to realize, you got to go back to the original movie and watch it. They were nightclub comedy sketches from the 60s. That was kind of the kind of sketch comedy Mel Brooks did. His stuff was more of the show of shows than it was Saturday Night Live. Now, Nick Kroll being involved in this is a little bit more connective tissue with something like The Kroll Show, but ultimately it's taking these absurd elements of history and making jokes about them. And they got a great cast. They got a bunch of cameos in there, and it's a lot of fun to see them. Yes, there's some jokes that don't land. There's some sketches that don't work, or there's sketches that overstay their welcome so much. There's one sketch in there, and I believe the whole thing's aired by now because it went over the course of the week on Hulu. But there's a sketch with Jesus and his disciples, and they're mirroring the Beatles, and it's about the recording session, and Mary Magdalene is basically the Yoko Ono of the group. It was fine for like a 3-minute sketch, but they did a whole series. They kept cutting back to it. They must have done 5 or 6, you know, little sketch episodes. And by that point, I was so tired of that sketch. I'm like, yeah, it's not as funny as you think it is. You're just playing the whole thing out. But then there are some that they come in and they hit it and they go, and or they have different segments of the sketches that really work. There's a brilliant little bit where Wanda Sykes plays Shirley Chisholm, who was the first black woman in Congress, doing her own sitcom. I mean, that's actually really clever. There's a lot of clever stuff going on in that. And Ike Barinholtz has some very funny stuff. You can tell the stuff that he's in charge of and kind of the stuff he's pushing. But it has some very funny moments. There are parts that I laughed out loud. And it's a half-hour show. So, you know, you burn through it and you're done. You got Mel Brooks doing the narration because he's not going to act it, and he's like 90. You could tell he's involved in it. I imagine he had a certain amount of oversight. So, you know, I liked it. I thought History of the World Part 2 was cool. I mean, it wasn't perfect. I mean, like any comedy, some of the jokes land and others fall flat. But there was enough clever sketches and surprising jokes for me to kind of hope for Part 3. I'd like to see more of this. It's nice, lighthearted, easy peasy watching. It's a half hour show and it's sketch comedy. So I'm going to say History of the World Part 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The next thing I want to talk about is The Magic Flute. A musical prodigy at an elite school finds himself torn between the real world and the fantasy one that plays out the challenges in Mozart's famous opera.
Where did you go last night?
Do you believe me?
Do I believe that a clock in the school is a portal into Mozart's beloved masterpiece? No.
What are you doing back there? I have no idea where I am.
The young prince, bring back my beloved daughter.
Are you ready, even at the peril of death?
Oh, I'm not sure about the whole peril of death part.
You should take a risk if you're going to figure out what it is you're missing.
First of all, look, I'm an uncultured Philistine, so I've never seen The Magic Flute. I don't know anything about it. I'm aware that Mozart wrote an opera called The Magic Flute. But this film, what it does is instead of just playing the story of The Magic Flute, it's about this kid at a boarding school. And like any of these boarding school movies, whether it's a Harry Potter film or something like Tom Brown's School Days, you have the bully in the school and you got the overbearing teacher and you got sort of the misfit that he's befriended. So you've got these archetypes in this that they work to a degree. And then he finds, like, I guess you could call it a key, allows him access to this fantasy world where it plays out the story of the magic flute. And that's actually kind of an interesting device. I mean, it's not unheard of. I mean, it's kind of a Narnia type thing. But when he gets into the magical world, people will sing and they do, it becomes a musical, not really an opera. I mean, it has operatic music at times. But the people will break out in songs, and I can forgive that. It's a little bit jarring going between the two worlds, because in the real world, you don't break out in song like that. For the most part, they've done a really good job getting performers to sing, and you can understand what they're saying, because what they sing actually propels a story. It sets up what's going to happen next. And there's a couple that they don't. There's a couple people who sing, and you can tell they're probably a classically trained opera singer. Whereas if you're singing an Italian opera, there are people who don't speak Italian who go see an opera and can understand it, because not just you can understand from the passion of the music, but you can read the playbill and you kind of know what the story is. But in this movie, it's kind of important to hear what they have to say. So at those moments, you lose the narration, essentially, because the singing's not too good, but it's too focused on the musical notes rather than the coherence of the lyrics. But it's really feels like something I probably would have appreciated more if I was like 12. It reminds me of the kind of movie I would have seen watching TV at my grandparents' house while I was there over Christmas and kind of really getting into it. But I mean, it looks decent. It's got some decent effects and it's got some good production design. The problem is it is juggling two different stories that are kind of meshed together, and neither one gets the full weight of the film. So you kind of get a distracted movie because it's trying to fulfill two separate storylines, but by spending so much time in each of them, neither one gets enough focus. So, I mean, it's still, you know, like I said, it wobbles in an attempt to balance the classic high fantasy opera with a modern teenage story, but there's quite a bit of charm in it and a compelling story. I did enjoy it. I thought it was a nice diversion from some of the other stuff that we've seen. So I'm going to say that the magic flute kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Scream 6 and Champions. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the new Scream movie, and that is Scream 6. And if you follow the numbering of this, it goes Scream, Scream 2, Scream 3, Scream 4, wait for it, Scream, and then Scream 6. So there's a hiccup in naming, but at least it's not as confusing as the Halloween franchise. The survivors of the previous film are going to school in New York City, only to discover a new ghost-faced killer is stalking them.
I had this secret. There's a darkness inside of me. It followed me here. And it's gonna keep coming for us.
This isn't like any other ghost face.
What is this place?
A shrine.
We've gotta lure him in.
We execute him.
Hello.
Let's play a game.
You know you're like the 10th guy to try this, right?
I've enjoyed the Scream movies. Part of the reason I like the Scream movies is because I grew up in the 80s, so I was a little too young to see the original slashers, like the original Halloween and Friday the 13th in the theaters, but I eventually got to see a lot of the sequels in the theaters, you know, stuff like, once it hit Halloween 4, I was seeing that in the theaters. I started watching Friday the 13th, somewhere around 6 or 7 in the theaters. And I think I saw Nightmare on Elm Street starting with episode 3 or 4 in the theater. So I was part of that 80s slasher movie generation. And the Scream movies were a deconstruction of those slasher movies. And it was also originally put together by Wes Craven, who did the Nightmare on Elm Street movie. So he was instrumental in making slasher movies a big thing in the 80s. And he ended up doing a movie that kind of broke them down in the end. That's not the only movie he did that broke it down. One of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, New Nightmare, absolutely deconstructs slasher movies. So this is something that Wes Craven had done before. And of course, Wes Craven passed away quite a while ago, but we now have a new Scream series. And I do think the premise is starting to get a little bit thin in terms of the how do you survive a scary movie and its self-awareness is turning into a snake eating its tail. I don't know how many more of these movies they can make and be so self-aware, because now they're not just being aware of slasher movies. They're aware of sequels and requels and reboots and franchises now. So the scene of the person explaining the rules of whatever, you know, whether it's a horror movie or a franchise, you're like, okay, I got enough of this. Also, it's nice that they have some of the people coming back, you know, like you've got Courtney Cox coming back as Gale Weathers. And look, I am not body shaming somebody. I'm cosmetic surgery shaming somebody. She looks like a elf from Lord of the Rings with the clips and nips and tucks she's done on her face and her nose and her ears. It could have been somebody else. It's like watching that second Mamma Mia movie and Cher shows up and you're like, I don't even think that's Cher. I think that's a robot. So they've also got Hayden Panettiere back, and she was in Scream 4. And even though she's in her 30s, I like how she's like, I'm 30 at one point. She like gives her age. And I'm like, no, you're not. You're like in your early to mid 30s. You shaved off a couple years, you know, just. And you can tell she's starting to get work done, too. And you're just like, oh, don't, because you look terrible. You're not fooling anybody. You don't look better with that cosmetic surgery. If there's anything I learned watching this movie on a 30-foot screen, it was don't get that kind of cosmetic surgery. Botox is not your friend. But going to the story, I do think it's funny because I think the producers are thanking God that they did not kill off Jenna Ortega's character in the first movie, because they could bring her back in this one, because now everybody wants to see Jenna Ortega because of Wednesday. She's hugely popular for that. And she's been sort of elevated into a lead role in this movie, along with Melissa Barea. And so overall, I mean, when it comes to a Scream movie, when it comes to a franchise movie, and it's fine. I mean, I think it's good. I enjoyed it. There are some things in there that are kind of predictable, but it's really, really hard to keep things undercover. But at this point, you have cycled through all the tropes and you either have to repeat yourself or find something that's overly obvious and then be like, oh yeah, that's the twist or whatever. But I mean, it plays like a screen movie. The thing I liked most about it was moving it to New York City, because for the most part, major slasher movies, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, they either take place in a small town or like a campground or something like that. They all take place in a small area, very limited population area. And by putting it in New York City, it changes the dynamic of it quite considerably. I know that there are some movies that have slasher movies like New York Ripper, and like, I think Terror Train takes place in a big city, but it takes place on a train. You know, but so they've done killer movies, serial killer movies in the big city. So this isn't 100% unique, but I think it's kind of cool that they did it. They certainly take Manhattan way better than Jason did in Friday the 13th Part 8, where he just kind of shows up in the last 10 minutes. And that's, I think, shows why Jason doesn't work in Manhattan, because they couldn't even do a whole movie there. They only put that in the third act. So, I mean, it's fine for what it is. I mean, it goes through the notes. It has some decent, exciting kills. It's a little bit bloody, but again, it's a slasher movie. It's not as brutal as some slasher movies are, but, you know, it works. And there's slashing going on in it. So I liked it. I thought it had the twists. Some of them I picked up on. Some of them I didn't. But overall, yeah, it works. You know, the self-awareness of the franchise is growing thin, but this installment still offers some good slasher thrills that made the other movies work. I'm going to say Scream 6 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Champions. Woody Harrelson plays a down-on-his-luck basketball coach who is ordered by a court to run a community league of players who are intellectually disabled.
Mr. Markovich, I will offer you community service. Coaching adults with intellectual disabilities.
It's impossible to coach these guys.
You don't have to turn them into the Lakers. They just need to feel like a team.
We're going to need some help.
You're getting a player off the injured list.
Welcome to the team, Cosentina. What's with the boogie board?
You do you, I do me, okay? Where do you get this guy?
He just showed up one day.
You know the game better than anybody.
You got to learn to build relationships.
I'm new to all this.
Yeah, can tell.
This is directed by Bobby Farrelly, one of the Farrelly brothers. And actually, if you know anything about the history of the Farrelly brothers, they have a very positive involvement with the community of people who are intellectually disabled. If you remember, there's something about Mary. The Farrelly brothers had a character that was intellectually disabled in that movie, and they had people who were interacting with folks in that community. They have a history with people who are intellectually disabled, so they have a very kind outlook on them, and that's one of the things that's good about this movie. The other thing this movie does, and I think this is the key to what makes it work, is it's not demonstrative and it's not pitiful. It presents people as people. This just happens to be who they are. Like, Woody Harrelson's character, it's not like he comes in as an intellectual bigot or anything. He's just never dealt with that community. And so he has some adjustments to make, but he adjusts pretty quickly, and he still sees everybody as a human being. And he doesn't have to overcome that. It's not like that was part of his core personality. He adapts really well. And I think that really kind of makes the movie work. And Woody Harrelson's good at it. I mean, he's a nutcase in real life. I mean, we all know his little anti-vax stance and stuff he talked about on Saturday Night Live. So yeah, he's a little bit goofy there, and he's always been goofy. And that's, I think, why I give him a pass, because this kind of stuff's nothing new from Woody Harrelson. I mean, if Tom Hanks were saying some of this crazy stuff, you'd be like, whoa, Hanks, slow down, man. But Woody Harrelson, he brings a charm to it. He brings a likability to the role and the characters. And I think it's very inclusive with how it deals with people in his basketball league. Because, like I said, he's not trying to fix them. He doesn't see them as something he has to fix. He sees the team he has to fix and get them to play as a team and to work together and to sort of whip the team into shape. But he's not there to fix the people. And I think that's good. It reminds me a little bit of the approach that Schitt's Creek, the TV series, takes on gay and lesbians. They don't have homophobic stories. They don't have homophobic characters coming after them. They're just people in the story. And their existence, they don't have to justify. That's just part of the thing. And while this is sort of the leaping point for the story, it works, and it has some very funny moments, and they got real people with intellectual disabilities playing those roles, and I think they do a great job. They're actually, honestly, they're some of the funnier comedians in this movie than Woody Harrelson or Caitlin Olson, who's also in it. So yeah, it's sweet. The grassroots charm keeps the film alive with imperfect characters that manage to grow without being mean-spirited. And we need more of that in the world today. So I'm going to say Champions kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Christmas, Bloody Christmas. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews, and I'm going to do another vintage review. If you remember last week, I took a look at Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. A lot of this is I'm rewatching these in preparation for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny that comes out this summer. And I'm going to talk about Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade now. The legendary archaeologist joins forces with his professor father in order to retrieve the Holy Grail.
Indiana Jones is on the quest of a lifetime. But for some adventures, one Jones is not enough.
Dad? Junior? Don't call me that, please.
Follow me! Out of the way!
You call this archaeology?
I remember the year this came out. This came out in 1989, and that was like a banner year. You had Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. You had Batman. You had Lethal Weapon 2, I think it was the second one that came out. So you had three really awesome movies that came out throughout like May, June, July. I mean, you had a really great tentpole summer that year. And this followed up the Temple of Doom. And I know a lot of people malign the Temple of Doom. Now, I, of course, defended it last week, and you can hear me talk about that. But I will admit, Temple of Doom was a bit of diversion from Raiders of the Lost Ark, partly because it abandoned the whole World War II Nazi side of it. So that was something you didn't have in Temple of Doom. The other thing you didn't have in Temple of Doom is it went away from the finding a religious artifact from the Judeo-Christian religion, you know, the Lost Ark. And of course, that plays into the Nazi stuff too. But you completely went off to a different type of adventure, which was a jungle adventure where they're dealing with Indian mythology and in India. And what The Last Crusade does is it comes back to sort of that original well that they had, not the Well of the Souls, but the original well for the story. Because it mimics a lot of the elements of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It has Nazis in it. Of course, it takes place during World War II. So it has Nazis in it, and they're the bad guys, and Nazis make the easiest bad guys, as they should. The Nazis are the bad guys. Remember that, people. It also goes after a Judeo-Christian artifact, which is the Holy Grail. I mean, it's not Judaism, but it is the Judeo-Christian line. And I always find it interesting when people are complaining about the magic, so to speak, in the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And I'm like, they opened an ark that melted people's faces. What are you talking about? They had magical stones that allowed you to rip somebody's guy's heart out. You had a, what, 700-year-old knight in a cave in this movie. So there was magic all over this stuff and sort of this mystical thing, but it was sort of Christian magic that makes it work. And that's for him going after the Grail. The big change with this one is they brought in Sean Connery as Indiana Jones' father. Now, people nowadays don't remember this, but in the early 80s, Sean Connery had a rough time. After making the James Bond movies and leaving that franchise in the early 70s, he kind of slummed it a lot. He made a lot of movies, but some of them were really quite terrible, you know, like Zardoz and stuff like that. And it wasn't until he was in The Untouchables in 1987 that he got an Academy Award nomination for that he suddenly came back on the map, and he came back not as young, sexy Sean Connery, but as old, sexy Sean Connery. You had a 1-2 punch of The Untouchables and then this, and then suddenly Sean Connery was the biggest name on the planet again. And this really helped galvanize him as a star leading into the 90s and then into the 2000s. But they had great chemistry. And of course, Spielberg does such a great job directing the movie. This is a great adventure, and it's staged very beautifully. I mean, to the point that, I mean, it's got a lot of depth in it. And I talked about this when I saw the 3D version of Jurassic Park, which wasn't shot for 3D, but there's so much depth in a Spielberg movie, it worked in a 3D setting. There's just some beautiful shots in this movie, but it does mimic a lot of stuff from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that's okay. I mean, it's a serial adventure, and that's fine. I mean, it was a strong return to form for Spielberg and the gang, offering a very strong third adventure. But, you know, at a certain time, you do have to branch out. There's other parts to the serial to imagine. And that's one of the reasons why now, going back, I like Temple of Doom. But I love how people say, oh, we don't have goofy stuff like nuking the fridge or anything like that. And I go, they have the whole tapestry scene in The Last Crusade, which is a really, it's a funny scene, but it's out of place. So, I mean, there's some real goofy stuff that goes on in this movie, but it's forgivable because it's an adventure and it's fine. And I liked it. So I'm going to say Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm going to be doing a Christmas movie, and that's mainly because it's available on DVD and Blu-ray now. It's on disc. And that is Christmas, Bloody Christmas. I know, it is not a family film. Spoiler alert. A robotic Santa Claus wreaks havoc on one dark Christmas night.
The U.S. Defense Department has spent over $1 trillion on the most cutting-edge robot technology. Introducing RoboSanta Plus for the upcoming holiday season.
What are you going to do this fine Christmas Eve?
I was potentially going to go meet up with a dude. I've blown him off twice already, so.
Come on, get a drink with your old pal, Robbie.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
New animatronic state-of-the-art Santa Claus is now the subject of an international recall.
This came out, obviously, at Christmas last year, but it was a small release, and then it was available on Shudder. It's still available on the Shudder streaming service if you have that. Or you can get it on disc now. You can get it on physical media. And it's just meant to be a big, bloody Christmas movie. And I appreciate certain things about it. Some things make me annoyed. Like the characters, the main characters are these people who work at a record store. And it sounds like they've made up half their dialogue because every other word is the F word. And I'm no prude. You can swear in front of me. But have you ever heard somebody who uses the F word like they're using in a sentence? You know, there are people who say a lot in a sentence. Well, there are people who use the F word instead of And that's kind of what happened. It feels like they just added it in there. Like the script didn't have it written. They just threw it in everywhere. And at a certain point, it gets annoying because it's competently written as a narrative feature, but the dialogue isn't great. And I think that they either improv or drop in the F word so many times it kind of loses its effect at a certain point. There is sort of this insipid dialogue between the two people who work at this record store, but it's strangely compelling. It's kind of like the Clerks stuff. It's not as clever as the OG Kevin Smith stuff that he had in Clerks, but it is kind of funny because they're talking about a bunch of different things because they have to set up all this stuff. And it takes like 30 minutes or so, 40 minutes before the Santa Claus starts killing people. It's a robotic Santa. They basically repurposed military technology to make an animatronic Santa in this toy store and it goes berserk. But it's also shot in such a way. It looks very, I'm not going to say it looks cheap. It looks low budget. It looks like it was shot in a similar style to cheesy slasher movies made in the 80s for like $50,000. It's grainy. The camera work's not fantastic. And it's very simple shots in a lot of ways. But I think that's deliberate. I think they're going for that aesthetic. And it works. It does work in that sense. And you know, like some of the kills, I know that's the thing that slasher people care about. You know, they are the kills interesting or cool? And that's one of the things like for Terrifier, part of the reason Terrifier 2 did so well is because they have such insane over-the-top kills in that series, even not just the Terrifier 2, but Terrifier 1. If you know anything about horror movies, there's a kill in Terrifier 1 that just, you know, a lot of people go crazy over. This one has some pretty insane kills, but some of them aren't staged terribly well, so it loses some points for that, because I'm like, well, if your shtick is Santa Claus running around killing people with an axe, you should at least do it well. When they get the back end of the movie, like the third act, it goes completely bonkers, and it's all about the action and the violence and the explosions, and it's got this mood lighting, this red and green Star Trek type of mood lighting, which of course comes from all of the Christmas lighting that exists in the movie, and it's also because it's this robot, it's like a Terminator. I mean, it is relentless in going after this one character, And I appreciate that. So it has these nods to other films, other better films, but it nods like I said, The Terminator. It gives nods to Silent Night, Deadly Night. There's certain things that reminded me, evoked thoughts of Gremlins and that sort of thing. But this is violent. This is very R-rated. It's for language and sex and violence. And of course, it's got a killer Santa Claus in it, so that's not necessarily something that the kids are going to want to see. But you know what? It worked for what it was. I mean, I appreciate the attention to horror movie detail and the Terminator-like stamina of the villain. You know, it's got some warts, but it's a bonkers Christmas horror movie in a good way. It's the kind of thing you could put on and have a lot of fun and just goof around, but I would not sit the family around and watch it like you would Elf or something like that. I'm going to give Christmas Bloody Christmas a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Anyways, that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Shazam, Fury of the Gods, and Ted Lasso Season 3. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.